This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. More than 12,000 research papers in the scientific literature make reference to the work of one man, Ken Caldera. That makes him one of the most influential scientists in the world of climate change. He's especially worried about the fate of coral reefs, which could suffer as the carbon dioxide we put into the air gets soaked up by the world's oceans. NPR sent science correspondent Richard Harris to Australia's Great Barrier Reef to spend some time with Caldera, a scientist who thinks big.
For a guy who spent most of his career behind a computer screen, Ken Caldera looks pretty nimble as he picks his way across a beach of coarse coral. He's wearing tattered nylon shorts and a floppy sun hat over his short, curly hair. And he's helping a band of young scientists and volunteers load boats to take their gear out to an experiment on the One Tree Island Lagoon.
Okay, we'll be right behind you.
On this expedition, he's hoping to find out whether he can reverse the damage that carbon dioxide is doing to the world's magnificent coral reefs. We pour billions of tons of carbon dioxide into the air, and a lot of it soaks into the ocean, making the water more acidic. That stunts the growth of coral. His team is pouring antacid into one small stretch of reef to see if they can reverse that process.
So what are these other snorkeling masks you think?
This is not where Caldera thought he'd be after he graduated from Rutgers with a BA in philosophy back in 1978. He started out writing software for Wall Street, but after a few years, he volunteered on a scientific expedition to study crocodiles in Latin America, and that sparked his interest in fieldwork.
And at the same time, I saw a newspaper article in the New York Times where there was discussion that the ice sheets might melt due to CO2 and global warming. And so I thought, well, this is important issues. And so I went to New York University and started studying climate change.
As it turns out, most of his research involves asking big questions, running some computer simulations, and getting approximate answers. Caldera likes to ask these overarching questions, and his answers can make headlines.
My work tends to be broad brush and high-level analyses. I always tell my postdocs and graduate students that we always try to say the first word on a subject, not the last word on a subject.
Science wouldn't really work if everyone tried to go after the flashy findings and not fret about chasing down all the details. But big-picture thinkers like Caldera also help drive the field. Over the years, he's calculated what it would take to cool the planet by spraying reflective particles into the atmosphere. He's calculated just how much clean energy production you'd need to replace all the fossil fuels we're using. But for all that, he loves being out on a reef doing firsthand research. And he has license to do this because he works at an unusual place. The Carnegie Institution for Science was endowed by industrialist Andrew Carnegie more than a century ago. So Caldera worries less about money than other scientists do.
My job offer letter said make important scientific discoveries, and they basically give me some resources and leave me alone to make important scientific discoveries.
His lab is on the Stanford campus, and his boss gives Caldera free range to take on risky projects like this. Here, he's trying to measure a tiny improvement in this reef, and he may simply not be able to detect it.
This is how the science gets pushed forward, by people taking risks, and maybe it will work and we'll be lucky, and maybe it won't.
In the world where science is often driven by a researcher's ability to get government grants, taking a risk like this is a luxury. But when Caldera steps back to look at the big picture, that leaves room for some startling insights. For example, it might seem that our vast skies have an endless ability to hold the billions of tons of carbon dioxide we put into it every year, but here's how Ken Caldera visualizes it.
If you were to compress the entire atmosphere down so it was the density of water, it would only be 30 feet deep. And so it's like all of the stuff that we're throwing into the atmosphere, we're throwing into an ocean that's only 30 feet deep.
In fact, when you look at the chemistry of the actual oceans, the carbon dioxide is already making a measurable change. It reacts with seawater and turns into carbonic acid, and that has made the oceans 30% more acidic than they were before the Industrial Revolution.
And this is a scale of change that hasn't happened for, since the dinosaurs became extinct. And so we're making radical transformations to ocean chemistry that go far beyond what most organisms have experienced in their evolutionary history.
Coral reefs were wiped out the last time this happened. Caldera's PhD work back in the 1980s showed that it took hundreds of thousands of years for the reefs to recover.
I care about water, man.
Out here on One Tree Island on Australia's Great Barrier Reef, Caldera and his crew gather every morning in the communal kitchen. They guzzle coffee, crunch cereal, fight off the sugar ants, and plan their day. Many of the floors in this rustic outpost are simply gravel-sized coral. Knotty terns, which roost everywhere, add their own special flavor to the drinking water, which is collected from the roof when it rains and stored in cisterns. The place feels magical, but the reef's peril is palpable. Caldera thinks about this, and he ponders what to do about it. It might be possible to save tiny patches of coral reefs by pumping acid-neutralizing chemicals on them, but it's simply not practical to scale that up, even for a single reef. Instead, Caldera keeps coming back to another big-picture solution, and that is to stop burning fossil fuels. Yes, energy will cost more, and as a result, there's huge resistance to this idea, but Caldera is hoping people will change their views if they simply frame the issue a different way.
Decades ago, everybody was smoking cigarettes, and it was acceptable to smoke cigarettes indoors. And there was a phase change in social acceptability where it's no longer acceptable to dump your cigarette smoke in air that somebody else is going to breathe. And I think we can achieve the same thing with carbon dioxide emissions, where it just becomes socially unacceptable to dump your industrial waste in the atmosphere.
Caldera is not optimistic that politicians will make this change. He's not planning to take to the streets. He tried that back in 1982 when he helped organize a huge protest against the nuclear arms race. He's moved on from that strategy. Now, he says, it's time to pay less attention to the problem and more to the solutions.
For me, the problem is clear, and that the solution is in transforming our energy system. And for young people coming into science today, my recommendation would be to work on developing improved energy systems, and I wouldn't advise people to go into climate science. I think it's fundamentally a solved problem.
In fact, Caldera makes this case to Microsoft founder Bill Gates, who sometimes calls on him for advice. If science and technology can make clean energy cheaper, he says, that would make it easier for people to look at the atmosphere differently, not as a waste dump, but as a vital part of our planet. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Also on this Earth Day, the world's greenest office building officially opens its doors. It's called the Bullitt Center, and it's an ambitious project by the environmentally progressive Bullitt Foundation. The goal here is to showcase an office building that is said to be entirely self-sustaining in energy and environmentally friendly in many other ways. The developers are hoping for a copycat effect here. But first, more on the new building from NPR's Wendy Kaufman in Seattle.
The first thing that strikes you about the new Bullitt Center is the windows. Walking up to the building in the city's Capitol Hill neighborhood, six stories of floor-to-ceiling glass soars above you. You notice I said walking up to the building. There's no on-site parking, and once inside, there's more walking.
In a building this size, any place else in Seattle, it would have two elevators, and that's what would face you as you walked in the front door. Here, the stairway is obvious, and it's attractive.
That's Dennis Hayes, president and CEO of the Seattle-based Bullitt Foundation. He explains there is an elevator, but it's tucked away. The staircase encourages exercise, and the concept saves money both in energy use and construction costs. This is but one of dozens of decisions and trade-offs that went into the building, a building Dennis Hayes describes as a living organism.
It has eyes, it has ears, it has a nervous system, it has a brain, and it responds to its environment in a way that seeks to optimize things.
He points across the street to a mini weather station. It sends data back to the building so it can decide what it should do to maximize comfort and conserve energy.
Whether the window should be open or should be closed, and whether the external shutters should be down or should be up, and if they're down, what angle they should be at to reflect as much sunlight as possible, as far as possible, into the building to give you daylighting at your desk.
Just about everything in this building is off-the-shelf technology, from photovoltaic cells on the roof to composting toilets. But never before has all the technology been integrated into a single building in quite this way.
I think it's fair to say that we were all a bit skeptical in the beginning.
Chris Rogers is the founding partner of Point 32, the firm that developed the $30 million project in conjunction with the Bullitt Foundation. Rogers and the others set out to meet the rigorous goals of the Living Building Challenge, including total self-sufficiency in energy and water and building materials that are free of toxins.
So down here in the basement is where you'll find the majority of the building systems, our composting toilet system, our underground water storage cistern.
But beyond the systems, the 160 or so people working inside will have a huge role in meeting the sustainability targets. The foundation occupies half of the top floor. The rest of the building is being leased out. The rent, market rate for a top-tier building, though many amenities you might expect for the price don't exist. And tenants have to live within an energy budget. Rob Pena of the University of Washington's Integrated Design Lab says energy use can be measured down to the individual socket.
That's quite unusual. There probably isn't a building in the country that's metered to the level this building is metered.
Clearly, this building is not for everyone. If you think of this simply as an office building, it was relatively expensive to design and build. But if you view it as a laboratory, an educational center, and a bold effort to change how things are built, the calculus changes. Still, one could ask, is it possible to replicate the self-sustaining features at a reasonable cost?
If this building isn't replicable, then this experiment will have failed.
Developer Chris Rogers is optimistic others will follow their lead. He points out that over the past couple of decades, many builders began incorporating green elements into their buildings. And Chris Cole, a construction cost analyst at the global engineering firm AECOM, adds,
the market changed. The market started to expect new buildings to have some of these features.
And the supply chain began to adapt. New products and services were created, and some costs began to fall. Cole believes the Bullitt Project could foster additional shifts in the marketplace.
As businesses and organizations seek to clean up their footprint.
Trade-offs between cost, fancy features, and sustainability will undoubtedly be made, and developers and tenants will make those decisions differently. Still, the Bullitt Foundation is encouraged by all the attention their building is getting from people around the world. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
As for life on the Mississippi, it's been a rough year. Drought, low water, and now record high water. Those are just some of the many problems facing barge operators, farmers, and environmentalists. Those stakeholders met recently in Chicago to discuss the Mississippi's most pressing needs, as NPR's David Shaper reports.
I'm standing here at the mouth of the Chicago River at the lock connecting it to Lake Michigan. This is where water from the Great Lakes drains into the Mississippi River system. The reversal of the Chicago River here over a century ago created a vital shipping link between the Great Lakes and the Gulf of Mexico. And today, 60% of the nation's agricultural exports move by barge up and down the Mississippi River system, as do billions of dollars worth of petroleum, coal, steel, and other commodities. It's a critical lifeline for the nation's economy, but one not without problems.
One is infrastructure.
Dell Wilkins is with the Canal Barge Company, which operates barges and tows all throughout the Mississippi River system. And by infrastructure, he means locks and dams, canal walls, flood walls, and levees.
Infrastructure is old, it's crumbling.
Wilkins says one barge could carry the freight equivalent of 144 trucks or 46 rail cars. Yet the nation's water infrastructure, he says, is generally left out of the transportation funding conversation in Washington until there's a crisis. And over the last 2 years, the Mississippi River has endured two near catastrophes. Major General John Peabody is commander of the Mississippi Valley Division of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
The extremes that this nation has faced in the heartland, from the largest recorded flood in the history of the lower Mississippi River, which is pretty astonishing, to the worst drought in over 50 years and all the challenges that bring, it's clearly focused political attention in a way that we haven't seen in quite a while on the issue of navigation.
Those weather disasters led to the Corps blowing up a levee to operate a floodway one year, and then blowing apart underwater rock outcroppings to keep barges from running aground the next. There are almost constant dredging needs up and down the river. There are not only issues with locks and dams, but some levees may not withstand the next great flood. And then there's the battle against invasive species, such as the Asian carp. And all of the channeling of the Mississippi upriver is diverting fresh water and vital sediment away from the wetlands in the river's Louisiana Delta. The state's Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden says that's got to stop.
We're steadily losing Louisiana's coastline, the equivalent of a football field of land in less than an hour, literally. And that's just going to accelerate if something's not done.
Other problems along the Mississippi include industrial pollution, as well as farm chemical and nutrient runoff, affecting water quality all the way down to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And while the Mississippi River is the lifeblood of a huge swath of the nation's economy, it's also a life source for nearly half of the nation's migratory birds, a quarter of our fish species, and the source of drinking water for millions of residents. Again, Lieutenant Governor Darden.
When you're talking about sustaining the river, you have to look at it from an environmental standpoint, from an economic standpoint, from a navigation standpoint. And every aspect of life along that river affects every other aspect of life along the river.
The problem is that there are so many divergent interests along the Mississippi and its tributaries across 31 different states.
It's that the system is so large, it intimidates cooperation.
Val Marmillion is managing director of America's Wetland Foundation and says as a result, the Mississippi's problems are usually addressed only on a crisis-by-crisis basis. Mark Davis, director of the Tulane Institute of Water Resources Law and Policy, agrees and says that's led to a balkanized Mississippi River management.
We don't treat it as though it's a river. For us, it's like a child that has, 800 parents.
And that, Davis says, leaves the river an orphan, whose needs are not always funded as a priority. America's Wetland Foundation is trying to create a coalition to speak on behalf of river issues with one voice. It also wants a compact among the Mississippi River states, similar to that signed by Great Lakes governors 5 years ago, one that protects the Mississippi River system for all the competing interests in it. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Last year's drought devastated Midwestern farms. This spring, heavy rains arrived, but the timing is not great, as Abby Fentress Swanson reports from Columbia, Missouri.
I might have to get that. Missouri Climate Center, this is Pat.
Climatologist Pat Ganan has been forecasting the weather in Missouri for a quarter century, so it's no surprise that his phone rang off the hook last year as the drought gripped the region. Now he's fielding calls about rain, which you can hear as it plunks down outside his office window. Ganan hangs up the phone and checks out the forecast.
Terrible. It's like a forecast of how much precipitation they're expecting to fall over the next 7 days, and this is the 3-inch contour, which pretty much covers a lot of Wisconsin, Illinois, Southeast, the Corn Belt.
In case you didn't catch that, the 3-inch contour means more rain is coming. Lots of it.
And so planning is going to be delayed big time if this verifies, according to the, and we're already, really wet here right now.
Yes, you heard that right. Much of the Corn Belt is having a really wet spring. Earlier this year, this moisture provided much-needed relief to one of the most brutal droughts in decades. Now farmers are hoping for a break from the rain so they can plant corn during a short window of time that will produce maximum yields.
There are other things that can limit yield, and planting date isn't necessarily even the most important one.
That's University of Missouri agronomist Brent Myers.
But it's something we have to consider, and we want to try to get the corn planted in that timely window of, say, after the first week of April to the first week of May.
That's what Missouri farmer Gary Riedel is hoping for, especially with corn still getting about $6.50 a bushel. Wearing a green baseball cap and Western-style shirt, he thrusts a hand into one of his planter's hoppers and grabs some salmon-colored corn seed he's itching to plant.
Last year, I believe I started planting on the 28th of March, and this year it may be the 28th of April, the way it's beginning to look.
Excessive heat and dryness can hurt corn pollination and stunt growth, leading to lower yields. So farmers try to plant early. The USDA says by this time last year, 26% of the country's corn crop was already planted. This year, farmers only have 4% of their corn in the ground. In one of his fields, Riedel is pointing to the reason.
See, there you can see a water puddle out in the field. We're going to have to wait till that dries up.
Planting in cold, wet soil can cause all kinds of problems for corn seedlings. But even up until January, this moisture is what farmers had been hoping for. Last year's drought led to a 13% drop in corn production, meaning tight corn stocks and increased competition for corn between ethanol plants and livestock producers. Agriculture economist Sterling Liddell says the shortfall's also hurting corn exports, which are now at a 40-year low.
A good production year would mean that there would be less competition and would improve margins, especially in the cattle industry, which has suffered the most.
Last year's drought moved Riedel to buy crop insurance for all of his 2,300 acres. 77-year-old farmer Peggy Smart also upped her coverage. Along with her family, she plants corn, soybeans, and wheat on 6,000 acres of Missouri River bottomland.
It's just crazy, you know, that one year is one way and one is another, so... And as I said, we don't have to go to Las Vegas to gamble because farming is the biggest gamble there is.
Both Smart and Riedel are hoping to minimize the risks of bad weather by trying out drought and flood-tolerant hybrid seeds this year. But first, they have to wait for the soil to dry out. For NPR News, I'm Abby Fentress-Swanson in Columbia, Missouri.
And that story came to us from Harvest Public Media, a public radio reporting project that focuses on agriculture and food production issues.
When you think of the Oklahoma-Texas rivalry, football probably comes to mind.
Red River rivalry is on. The game never gets old. It always has a huge meaning.
But on Tuesday, the two states will face off in the U.S. Supreme Court. The winner gets water. And as Joe Wirtz from member station KGOU reports, this is not a game.
The story begins in North Texas, one of the fastest growing regions and one of the fastest growing states. Cities like Arlington and Fort Worth are expanding. Jobs, businesses, and new development are booming.
It's a continuous rooftop from Dallas all the way to the Oklahoma border.
Linda Christie is the government relations director for the Tarrant Regional Water District, the water authority for an 11-county swath of North Texas. She says this economic engine is fueled, in part, by water. But drought has hit Texas hard, and she says all this growth could dry up.
Well, you can't have economic development of an area without a sustainable, stable water supply. All of the locations, watershed locations close by, have been tapped for us. So now we're going to have to go 200, 300 miles, and most of it would be water that is being pumped uphill.
The Red River seems like an ideal solution. It's fed by the Rocky Mountain snowpack, and it forms the border between Oklahoma and Texas as it flows southeast toward the Gulf of Mexico. The two states have a formal agreement on how to share water from the river. In 1980, Congress ratified the Red River Compact, giving Oklahoma and Texas, along with Arkansas and Louisiana, an equitable apportionment of water from the river and its tributaries. But what's equitable is arguable. Christie says Texas has to reach across the river to get its fair share.
The problem is the Red River lies entirely within the state of Oklahoma.
Southeastern Oklahoma is the opposite of North Texas. Boarded up storefronts decomposed next to abandoned gas stations consumed by weeds. The people here are poor, but the land is water rich, thanks to a confluence of rivers and reservoirs built with federal funding. Cities and towns throughout Oklahoma rely on this water, and the state has blocked Texas's efforts to tap it. And here's where the Supreme Court comes in. Texas says that 1980 compact gives it access to water that flows into the Red River, including water in the Kiamichi River.
And you look at the attachment that describes the subbasin, and it's highlighted in pink. It shows that it goes across state boundary lines.
And that's the rub. The Kiamichi River lies entirely within Oklahoma's borders. Oklahoma argues the Red River Compact authority does not supersede its own. State Senator Jerry Ellis' Capitol office is 200 miles away from his southeastern Oklahoma district, but he's still surrounded by water. There's a small water fountain in the middle of his office wall. A piece of paper is taped to it, and it bears a handwritten message, "Water for Texas no more." Ellis says North Texas hasn't gotten serious about conservation and is lying about its water needs.
Our poor, thirsty people in Dallas, Texas, there's nobody thirsty in Dallas, Texas.
Senator Ellis authored some of those protectionist laws that restricted out-of-state water exports. When it comes to water, Ellis says every state is out for themselves, especially in a drought. He doesn't believe Texas will be a good neighbor.
You know, it's like giving Jack the Ripper a set of hunting knives on his promise to use them only at the dinner table. I'm telling you right now, it's not going to happen.
For years, Oklahoma and Texas have been trading legal and PR attacks in the Tarrant case. Oklahoma has won all the lower court battles so far, but Texas is encouraged that the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case. Tarrant hopes Oklahoma's anti-water export laws are struck down and the authority of the Interstate Compact is reaffirmed. The Tarrant Water District has also been emboldened by a friend of the court brief filed by the U.S. Solicitor General, who sided with Texas.
It all revolves around the question of whether water is a commodity in and of itself.
That's Stephen Draper, a water expert who helped write guidelines for interstate water sharing for the American Society of Civil Engineers. He says the outcome of the Oklahoma-Texas water fight could have national ripple effects. Here's why. The Red River Compact contains a lot of the same boilerplate language used in other state-to-state water-sharing agreements. If the court upholds Oklahoma's anti-export laws, Draper says other states could be inspired to pass similar laws of their own. For NPR News, I'm Joe Wirtz.
That story comes to us from State Impact, a collaboration between NPR and member stations. And you are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
On this 43rd Earth Day, organizers declared a theme, the face of climate change, which only suggests how much things have changed since April 22, 1970, when most who turned out for the first Earth Day spoke about clean air and clean water long before climate change had emerged as an issue. Lester Brown joins us now. He's president of the Earth Policy Institute and author most recently of Full Planet, Empty Places, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. He's on the phone with us from his office here in Washington. Nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be here, Neil.
And when you look back at that first Earth Day, well, a whole lot has changed since then, don't you think?
Yeah. In 1970, the big focus was on pollution. I mean, it was Silent Spring with in 1962 that had triggered the evolution and formation of the modern environmental movement, and that was pollution oriented. And what we've seen since then is a shift to focus on environmental support systems like the natural systems like forests and grasslands and fisheries and so forth and what's happening to them. And now, of course, climate change is on the issue and water has become a major issue. These were not on the agenda in 1970. At that time, it was largely a focus on pollution, and that was at the time when the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland caught fire because there was so much oil and other combustible material there. So it was pollution. Now it's many things.
It was just a couple of months after that first Earth Day, Congress authorized the creation of the EPA, a federal agency that regulates environmental regulations. The EPA has, of course, gone from an agency created with great bipartisan support to one of the most partisan ideas in government.
Yeah, I think as I recall, the first head might have been Russell Train.
I believe you're right.
Who was a Republican who was one of the early individuals concerned about the what was happening to the environment. He was an early leader, so EPA is now 40 plus years old. I still think of it as one of the newer agencies around town, but it's not really so new anymore.
And we think at the first blush, of course, this issue had been around forever, but going even back to Silent Spring in 1962, it is this kind of consciousness is relatively new, at least as a major public issue.
It is, and that's partly because of the environmental effects of human activity were quite small. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of the last century, 1900, the global economy then was only maybe 2% of what it is today. So human activity was very limited, even if it were in many ways environmentally careless. But now, given the size of the world economy and the pressures on the Earth's natural systems and resources, whether it's forest resources or the capacity of the system to absorb and process waste, and of course the capacity to absorb CO2 and climate now being probably the big environmental issue.
Even 43 years ago, the climate change was an issue. We just didn't know it yet. Among the things that was occurring that has occurred since then has been an amazing improvement in climate science.
There has been. There were very few meteorologists beyond those doing the, the daily weather reports. Climate science was not a big thing because climate had not been changing. I mean, the period since the beginning of agriculture 11,000 years ago has been one of rather remarkable climate stability. So the idea of climate change is a relatively recent concept, and the process of human driven climate change is quite recent historically.
And we look at the biggest example is looking at the past through either tree rings or ice cores to get an idea of what has happened in previous periods of climactic change.
We look at these indirect indicators to sort of reconstruct earlier periods in the Earth's history or in human history. And what we do know is that for the 11,000 years since agriculture began, things have been sort of stable. But now suddenly, the farmers now on the land are the first generation of farmers to have to cope with climate change. I mean, we've always had to. When I was farming back in the 50s, we had to worry about weather, how the weather would affect that particular year's crop. But climate change was not on the on our minds then. We didn't even know that we were going to be changing climate as we now are.
Another thing that has changed has been the public attitude. I covered that first Earth Day in New York City. There were rallies all over the country. I was at the one in Union Square in New York. The atmosphere that day was electric, and as mentioned, some of the legislation began to pass shortly thereafter with enormous bipartisan majorities in both houses of Congress and signed by a Republican president. And public opinion polls these days shows that the environment is pretty far down the list of people's concerns.
That's right. Interestingly, one of the reasons that Richard Nixon was so strong on environmental issues is because his likely opponent in 1972 for his reelection was going to be Ed Muskie from Maine. And Ed Muskie had spoken out very strongly on environmental issues and had raised this as a concern. And in order to sort of undermine that concern, Nixon really took the initiative on the climate front, and what was for him very much a political issue was for us an important advance in public policy as it related to the environment.
And as we look ahead, these issues are going to be more and more significant, at least that's what the climate scientists tell us. How does it change to get to make it more of a priority in people's opinions and in politics?
There are various models of social change. One is the what I call the Pearl Harbor model, where you have an event that changes everything. Sometimes it's pressures gradually building and awareness building. I call that the Berlin Wall model, where things keep building until, in the case of the Berlin Wall, it went down. And sometimes it's difficult to see those tipping points before you reach them. Almost by definition, tipping points are difficult to project and identify. But my own sense is that we are moving toward a tipping point on the climate issue, and it's going to take a few more droughts like the one in the summer of 2012 and intense heat that greatly reduced the U.S. grain harvest. I think it reduced the corn harvest by close to 30%. Storms unlike anything we've seen before. And then we'll begin to, at some point, realize that climate change is for real, that it's dangerous, that it's costly, and that we need to be doing something about it.
Yet you'd like to think that we could arrive at these kinds of decisions on a rational basis, don't need a tremendous crisis to focus our attention.
One would like to think that, but more often than not, and all too frequently, it takes some sort of a crisis to goad us into action.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Lester Brown, president of the Earth Policy Institute, author most recently of Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. He joined us by phone from his office in Washington.